Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 613, titled The Socialism of Fools, Part 2, subtitled American Dreyfus. This program is being recorded on October 7th of the year 2007. A French social critic, I believe it was, might have been Belgian, in the early 20th century observed of anti-Semitism, saying, quote, "It is the socialism of fools," unquote. And I did part of the series of programs that I did, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, and I did a program about anti-Semitism, which is growing worldwide, and called it the Socialism of Fools. Well, this is part two, the Socialism of Fools part two, subtitled American Dreyfus. Now, the Dreyfus case in France was the charging of a French officer named Dreyfus, who was Jewish, with espionage, and basically he was blamed for having subverted the French military effort in the Franco-Prussian War. In 1870, there was a war, obviously, between Prussia and France, the Franco-Prussian War, which resulted in a swift and very decisive Prussian victory. It resulted in the besieging of and seizure of Paris, and in part to blame someone other than their own officer corps, but even more to blame someone other than themselves, French society, rather than confront the profound shortcomings in French society, which had helped to undermine the French military resistance to the Prussian invaders, including the deficiencies in the French military establishment and the general staff. Rather, the French defeat, the overwhelming collapse of the French front in the Franco-Prussian War, was blamed on Jewish subversion from within. I think that on the contemporary political landscape, we're seeing something very similar or analogous in certain important respects, in that some very significant and very unfortunate and ultimately perhaps catastrophic or apocalyptic with a capital C or capital A events are being ascribed to some manner of Jewish conspiracy, either inside and or in particular internationally, involving supposed elements in the United States and supposed elements in Israel. Whereas, in fact, what is underlying these dynamics concerns some of the depredations of the petroleum industry internationally, and yet rather than confronting not only the tremendous power of the petroleum industry, both its economic power and its political power, and potentially the military power that it can call to its command, but also the beyond that, the complicity of a great many people in the profligate use of petroleum resources. Because indeed, it's not just the big oil companies, it's not just the Saudi moguls or the Kuwaiti moguls or the wild-eyed Iranian mullahs, but it's also Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships, not necessarily at sea, but sailing down the freeway in their sport utility, or as I call them, sport futility vehicles, or as I also call them, Wahhabi wagons. So that rather than confront the fact that, yeah, well, you know, maybe some changes have to be made from the kinds of cars people drive to the way they live, to beyond that, the way nations and giant corporations conduct their affairs, rather than confront that, I think people are being told that it was to choose, yeah? And in this regard, not only do I think contemporary American society is analogous to the corrupt French society of the late 19th century, the one that first succumbed to the Prussian armies and then blamed that failure on some sort of Jewish subversion from within, culminating in the Dreyfus case, rather than confront the profound shortcomings in American society, our attitude toward fossil fuels in particular, and in many different respects, we're being told it's, quote, the Israel lobby, unquote, in terms of shaping policy, or, you know, it was the Mossad that did it in terms of just about everything from the World Trade Center to the weather. And in this regard, I think we are looking at a phenomenon which, as surprising as it is in certain respects, at the same time, I think upon reflection is not only recognizable, but is recognizable because to a certain extent it's predictable. And it's predictable to a certain extent because it's happened before. So what we're going to do, or what I'm going to attempt to do in this program, is to lay out some of the political and economic relationships which help to spawn some of the political culture that leads people, that seduces people into believing in the socialism of fools. And we're going to take a look at the American Dreyfus case, in which the Israel lobby or a Jewish conspiracy is being blamed for what the petroleum industry is in point of fact doing. And we're going to take a look at the fact that the President of the United States, a true false, or a quick examination, the President and Vice President of the United States are A, rabbis, or B, petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas. Well, if I could encapsulate this entire program in one brief pill, so to speak, that would be it. But we're going to be exploring the socialism of fools, and we're going to be taking a look at America's early 21st century Petro-Dreyfus case. And by way of examining some of the political and economic relationships that helped to precipitate the socialism of fools, we're going to turn to a really important book, a book that I think explains some of the economic relationships that lead to a culture that condones genocide. It's happened a number of times, and if in point of fact it happens again, then we'll at least have the opportunity to understand what's going on. That book is called The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. It's authored by Christopher Simpson and published in soft cover by the Common Courage Press, copyright 1995. Now, The Splendid Blonde Beast is a phrase that Christopher Simpson borrowed from Nietzsche, and it was Nietzsche's view that human political affairs should be dominated by a splendid blonde beast, magnificent to behold and utterly ruthless in its attitude toward those weaker than itself. And Christopher Simpson uses that image, the image of the splendid blonde beast, to create a political concept. And it's a political concept that derives from economic relationships. And Christopher Simpson explains this on the last two pages of the regular text of his book, the regular body of text of his book, The Splendid Blonde Beast. Of The Splendid Blonde Beast, he writes, "Who then, or what, is the splendid blonde beast? It is the destruction inherent in any system of order, the institutionalized brutality whose existence is denied by cheerleaders of the status quo at the very moment that they feed its appetite for blood. The present world order supplies stability and rationality of a sort for human society, while its day-to-day operations chew up the weak, the scapegoats, and almost anyone else in its way. This is not necessarily an evil conspiracy of insiders. It is a structural dilemma that generates itself more or less consistently from place to place and from generation to generation. Much of modern society has been built upon genocide. This crime was integral to the emergence of the United States, of Tsarist Russia and later the USSR, of European empires and of many other states. Today, modern governments continue extermination of indigenous peoples throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America, mainly as a means of stealing land and natural resources. Equally pernicious, though often less obvious, the present world order has institutionalized persecution and deprivation of hundreds of millions of children, particularly in the Third World, and in this way kills countless innocents each year. These systemic atrocities are for the most part not even regarded as crimes, but instead are written off by most of the world's media and intellectual leadership as acts of God or of nature, whose origin remains a mystery. It is individual human beings who make the day-to-day decisions that create genocide, reward mass murder, and ease the escape of the guilty. But social systems usually protect these individuals from responsibility for authorized, unquote, acts, in part by providing rationalizations that present systemic brutality as a necessary evil. Some observers may claim that men such as Alan Dulles, Robert Murphy, and the rest were gripped by an ideal of a higher good when they preserved the power of the German business elite as a hedge against revolution in Europe. But in the long run, their intentions have little to do with the real issue, which is the character of social systems that permits decisions institutionalizing murder to take on the appearance of wisdom, reason, or even justice among the men and women who lead society. Progress in the control of genocide depends in part on confronting those who would legitimize and legalize the act. The cycle of genocide can be broken through relatively simple but politically difficult reforms in the international legal system. It is essential, particularly when such deeds have assumed a mantle of respectability, and to ensure just and even-handed punishment for those responsible. But the temptation will be to accept the inducements and rationalization society offers in exchange for keeping one's mouth shut. The choice is in our hands. Well, of course, Christopher Simpson was philosophizing about what is necessary to break the cycle of institutionalized genocide. And beyond that, commercial and economic co-enabling of genocide, which is really what he's talking about. I think, though, that before that can be adequately done, we have to recognize just exactly what really is taking place. I want to, at this point in the discussion, refer members of the listening audience to the mini-library, so to speak, of anti-fascist books that are available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. On that on the Spitfire website and in that section, there is literally an entire mini library of a dozen or so old anti-fascist books, which explain in considerable detail what fascism really is. It was not, as we have been told, some guy with a toothbrush mustache hypnotizing all the Germans and making them all go crazy, and then it was a bad war, and then along came the Allies, and then everybody lived happily ever after, or they would have, but along came another bad man named Joseph Stalin and hypnotized all the Russians and made all them go crazy. So then we had the Cold War, but rather fascism and German National Socialism in particular were the outgrowths of some very powerful political and economic forces which are at the foundation of modern industrial society today. It was not an aberration, and the people and the individuals who brought it about and the people and the individuals who preserved the institutions that brought it about and caused them to thrive into the modern era, those are people and institutions whose names dominate the current geopolitical landscape. So, what is the splendid blonde beast? Well, we're going to take a look at the economic and political realities underlying some of the venality. But first, let's look at some of the venality itself. And being in the media in a capacity of sorts, which obviously I am, it's sort of interesting to see the growth in a type of anti-Semitic discourse or cognition that I'd really only read about in books or seen in artistic or cultural works of art about the Nazi period. One thing comes to mind in the movie Cabaret, starring Liza Minnelli and Michael York and a few other people. At one point in a rooming house near the end of the film, a rooming house in which Michael York is staying, a woman's husband is reading the Völkischer Beobachter, which is the Nazi Party paper, and his wife asks him, "I don't understand, how can the Jews be both communists and bankers at the same time?" And he says, "Simple. If they don't get us one way, they get us the other." And that, I think, in some ways epitomizes the fundamentally irrational type of political perception and attendant communication that I'm seeing. I've got a generally friendly and well-meaning piece of correspondence the other day in which someone was talking quite frankly about how I should follow someone else's example and begin accessing stories about Israel dropping atomic bombs on Lebanon during the war in the summer of 2006. And I thought it reminded me of, well, I don't understand. How can the Jews be both communists and bankers at the same time? Well, simple. If they don't get us one way, they get us the other. We're going to take a look at some of the political relationships that helps to bring about this kind of thing. But the level of dialogue and the level of discourse that is characterizing the rise of the socialism of fools and that is helping to drive the American Dreyfus case, the Petro-Dreyfus case that is gathering momentum. Well, listen to the following. This is a column, an op-ed column from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, September 13th of 2007. It's by Victor Davis Hanson. It's headlined, Looking for a Scapegoat. Who recently said, quote, these Jews started 19 crusades. The 19th was World War I. Why? Only to build Israel, unquote. Some holdover Nazi? Hardly. It was former Prime Minister Necmettin Erbakan of Turkey, a NATO ally. He went on to claim that the Jews, whom he refers to as bacteria, unquote, controlled China, India, and Japan, and ran the United States. By the way, I would also add that Mr. Erbakan is very, very close to Ahmed Huber, who's a Nazi and a director of Bank al-Taqwa. And in fact, it was the close relationship between Ahmed Huber and Mr. Erbakan that led to Ahmed Huber being appointed a director of Bank al-Taqwa. That will be in the description for the Record program number 611. It's already in the description for the Record program 455. So, continuing with Victor Davis's column, Looking for a Scapegoat, who alleged the Arabs were involved in 9/11 cooperated with the Zionists, actually. It was a cooperation. They gave them the perfect excuse to denounce all Arabs, unquote. A conspiracy nut? Actually, it was former Democratic U.S. Senator James Aberesk of South Dakota. He denounced Israel on a Hezbollah-owned television station, adding, quote, I marveled at the Hezbollah resistance to Israel. It was a marvel of organization of courage and bravery, unquote. I would also add, James Aberesk was the first Arab-American to serve in the United States Senate. He also was one of the principal people involved with the Bureau of Native American Affairs, and as such, presided over a number of the scandalous unfoldings that have touched on some of the abuses of various Native American populations, including his name cropped up in connection with the Cabazon scandal in the early 90s, and the investigation of Danny Casolaro. So Aberesk himself is an interesting fellow, and more to the level of dialogue that's becoming more commonplace, returning to the Victor Davis Hanson column. And finally, who claimed that a United Nations-sponsored conference that democratic Israel was, quote, much worse, unquote, than the former apartheid South Africa, and that it, quote, undermines the international community's reaction to global warming, unquote. A radical environmentalist wacko? Again, no. It was Claire Short, a member of the British Parliament. She was a secretary for international development under Prime Minister Tony Blair. A new, virulent strain of the old anti-Semitism is spreading worldwide. This hate, of a magnitude not seen in over 70 years, is not just espoused by Iran's loony president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, or radical jihadists. The latest anti-Semitism is now also mouthed by world leaders and sophisticated politicians and academics. Their loathing often masquerades as anti-Zionism, unquote, or legitimate, unquote, criticism of Israel, but the venom exclusively reserved for the Jewish state betrays their existential hatred. Israel is always lambasted for entering homes in the West Bank to look for Hamas terrorists and using too much force. But last week, the world snoozed when the Lebanese army bombarded and then crushed the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp, which harbored Islamic terrorists. The world has long objected to Jewish settlers buying up land in the West Bank, yet Hezbollah, flush with Iranian money, is now purchasing large tracts in southern Lebanon for military purposes and purging them of non-Shiites. Here at home, and this next passage is a very important one, and this is something on which we're going to linger. Here at home, neoconservative, unquote, has become synonymous with a supposed Jewish cabal of Washington insiders who hijacked U.S. policy to take us to war for Israel's interest. That our State Department is at the mercy of a Jewish lobby is the theme of a recent, high-profile book by professors at Harvard University and the University of Chicago. Yet when the United States bombed European and Christian Serbia to help Balkan Muslims, few critics alleged that American Muslims had unduly swayed President Bill Clinton. By the way, one of the interesting things about the this line of non-thinking, I guess one would have to call it, if one actually examines the vast bulk of American military interventions in the last quarter of a century, most of them actually have been on behalf of Muslim populations, which is not to say that a lot of those adventures haven't been pretty cynical, but the first Gulf War was ostensibly at least in part, on behalf of Kuwait, certainly a Muslim country. The first Afghan war against the Soviets, which we supported and fought using proxy wars, was obviously a Muslim country. It was true in the Balkans, where we went to bat on behalf of first Bosnia and then Kosovo, after helping with Germany to destabilize the former Yugoslavia. And basically, the bulk of American military interventions have been on behalf of Muslim states. But we're going to get back to the subject of the use of the term neoconservative. It's come to generate a usage, a context, that is not unlike the use of the term cosmopolitan in Russian society, both under the Tsar and later under Stalin and even into the present period. The term cosmopolitan in Russian political discourse means, quote, Jew, unquote. And indeed, when one hears the neoconservatives being blamed for the Iraq War, they're not talking about James Baker, they're not talking about George Bush, they're not talking about Dick Cheney or any of the other people associated with the petroleum industry or related industries. They're talking about Jews. In fact, they're talking about Paul Wolfowitz, who isn't even Jewish. He's product of a mixed marriage, carries his father's last name. His father was Jewish. Paul Wolfowitz isn't. And in point of fact, the recent scandal in which he... thank God was finally shown the door at the World Bank had to do with him basically greasing the door, basically greasing the path for his Saudi Muslim girlfriend, and that ultimately got him into trouble. Arguably, something we're going to talk about later, but arguably the linchpin, and I use that literally, of the Republican right wing is Grover Norquist, who has not only married a Palestinian Muslim woman, but when asked by a conservative Republican congressman if he had converted to Islam, because the Palestinian Muslim population is among the most conservative in the Middle East, and marrying outside of the Muslim faith is frowned upon, to say the least. When asked by a colleague if he had converted to Islam, Grover Norquist said, quote, "That's too personal a question," unquote. Well, ladies and gentlemen and boys and girls in the audience, what do you think he meant by that? When Grover Norquist, again, the linchpin of the GOP, right, this is Grover, we've got to privatize everything in the whole world, including both halves of your very own rear end. Norquist marries a Palestinian Muslim woman and is asked, has he converted to Islam? And he says, quote, "That's too personal a question," unquote. This is an individual who is known by his friends as, quote, "Grocer Nose Twist," unquote. What do you think he meant by that? So again, watch the use of the term neoconservative. Watch in particular the context, because I think that Victor Davis Hanson is certainly not the first person to make this particular discrimination here, but I think he's absolutely correct. And you listen to the use of neoconservative, it means the Jews. Continuing with his column, and we're getting near the end of this side. Here at home, neoconservative has become synonymous with a supposed Jewish cabal of Washington insiders who hijacked U.S. policy to take us to war for Israel's interest. That our State Department is at the mercy of a Jewish lobby is the theme of a recent high-profile book by professors at Harvard University and the University of Chicago. Yet, when the United States bombed European and Christian Serbia to help Balkan Muslims, few critics alleged that American Muslims had unduly swayed President Bill Clinton. And such charges of improper ethnic influence are rarely leveled to explain the billions in American aid given to non-democratic Egypt, Jordan, or the Palestinians, or the Saudi oil money that pours into American universities. The world likewise displays such a double standard. It seems to care little about the principle of so-called occupied land, whether in Cyprus or Tibet, unless Israel is the accused. Mass murdering in Cambodia, the Congo, Rwanda, and Darfur has earned far fewer United Nations resolutions of condemnation than supposed atrocities committed by Israel. A number of British academics are sponsoring a boycott of Israeli scholars, but leave alone those from autocratic Iran, China, and Cuba. There are various explanations for the new anti-Semitism. For many abroad, attacking Jews and Israel is an indirect way of damning its main ally, the United States, by implying that Americans are not entirely evil, just hoodwinked by those sneaky and far more evil Jews. At home, there are obvious pragmatic considerations. Some Americans may find it makes more sense to damn a few million Israelis without oil than it does to offend Israel's adversaries in the Middle East, who number in the hundreds of millions and control nearly half the world's petroleum reserves. Cowardice explains a lot. Libeling Israel won't earn someone a fatwa or a death sentence in the manner comparable criticism of Islam might. There are no Jewish suicide bombers in London, Madrid, or Bali. This new face of anti-Semitism is so insidious because it is so well disguised, advanced by self-proclaimed diplomats and academics, and now embraced by the supposedly sophisticated left on university campuses. When national, collective, or personal aspirations are not met, it is far easier to blame someone or something rather than to look within for the source of the failure and frustration. More recently, someone must be blamed for getting terrorists mad at us. That someone is, no surprise, once again, the Jews. And again, I think that some of what Victor Davis Hanson had to say there might seem a little facile under the circumstances, but note the term, the use of the term neoconservatives, because neocons for a great many people means Jews. And we're going to take a look at the use of the term the Israel lobby. It's become very much like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and we're going to take a look at the Mossad did it theory. Of various things, including the September 11th attacks, time permitting, or the theory. But that all is going to have to come on side two. Please do utilize the vast bulk of information that's available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. We've been having a little trouble with the Google Spitfire search function, so we've switched it over temporarily to Yahoo. So use Yahoo to search the Spitfire website. And please do take advantage of the vast amount of information on the Spitfire and linked websites, including the mini library of anti-fascist books to which I alluded. If some of the things that I talk about on this broadcast seem a little strange, if they seem incomprehensible, a little high-blown, check out those books. Fletch out your understanding, and I think it'll make a whole lot more sense than it might at first. But this concludes side one of For the Record program number 613, The Socialism of Fools, part two, American Dreyfus, being recorded on October 7th of the year 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.